Welcome to the Lob Podcast, brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to the Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present, with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
In terms of coaching, Ricky, which, you know, sort of the one thing I also want to come on to, and was it always your intention to coach and to want to be a coach, even as a player, or is it something that post-career you felt that you wanted to go into, or was it always an ambition of yours?
I think for me, Stu, it was a natural transition progression in my own mind, even from a young age. I'd never really sat down, because whilst you're a player, you generally just concern yourself with playing and you think you're going to play forever and you think this is never going to end. And then suddenly Father Time catches up with you and then you realise, oh crikey, what other interests do I like? But for me personally, I used to go back to my community on a Tuesday or Thursday night, even when I was a young pro at Luton, and coach my amateur side, which was Leary Constantine. A West Indian club within the Northwest London in Willesden. And I used to go there and coach the players that were playing in that team, because I wanted to impart the knowledge that I had and the stuff that I'd learnt at training within those players and the community, and to help them if there were anyone that was particularly any good, to see if I could find a pathway to help them find a pathway into professional football. So I've always been that type of person and personality. So in the back of my mind, without really clinically sitting down and thinking, yes, I want to coach at Tottenham Hotspur or Manchester United, I'd never really given it that type of in-depth thought, but I've always felt that the way I played the game, how I conducted myself during the game, how I trained, you know, just my general being, I always thought that that could be something that would be of interest to the game, would be helpful to the game. I think I would be good at mentoring players and teaching players, you know, right from wrong. And also in terms of how the game should be played, I think I've got a good grasp of that, you know, from my own experience of self-development into stylistically and playing wise. So I think it, for me, I always, back in my mind, yes, but I'd never given it any real thought. So when the time came in regards to getting an opportunity, it came out of the blue. And I was still a player at Tampa. I just left England. I think I'd come back from France, went to Leicester City. Brian Little had come in and I didn't really fit into his plan. So I got my contract severed, got paid up, and I went back home. And at the time, the English game had started to change quite a bit in regards to a player like myself who likes to get on the ball and caress it and make other people play, and just that technical element. The midfield players of that generation was beginning to come more of a box-to-box, the Vinnie Jones, you know, Carlton Palmer to a degree, Laurie, you know, guys that, you know, would put the effort in, commitment, break things up, do simple things well, great. But for me, someone who prided himself on being creative, very incisive with the ball, progressive passer, I didn't know if many teams catered for that type of player at that time, particularly when I was at 31, 32 years old. And then I ended up going to America with Rodney Marsh at Tampa Bay Rowdies. And after 6 weeks, Rodney said to me, Ricky, he said, do you fancy becoming player coach? And we already had two coaches. He was going to get rid of them. And I thought, well, wow, you know, why? So I said, yeah, I'll have an opportunity. And from there, I kind of just got thrown into it, but it didn't faze me. And I was able to then do some things that in my own mind, I felt, well, I'd like to train like this. I think the lads would enjoy that. I think that so it was kind of trial and error scenario, but I wasn't intimidated by it. And I think the guys that I worked with enjoyed my sessions, enjoyed my mannerism, enjoyed my honesty. But I always believe, you know, I've seen certain managers who not treated all players the same way. I'm a great believer that one, you're only as strong as the weakest link. So I never, you know, whether you're playing or not, I would devote as much attention as I could in the right way to you, as much advice, as much help as I could. And I think the players respected that. And we had a reasonable first season as a coach. And from there, I guess it cemented my bug to become a full-time coach, to try to emulate my playing career in my coaching and managerial career. And to date, that is where I've been aiming for, but I haven't managed to do so to date, in my estimation anyway, Stuart.
Stephen, you talk a lot about the potential of Xabi Alonso as a coach. You've mentioned a couple of times about him as a prospective Liverpool coach. Do you think that, you know, Ricky made a great point there about, you know, the type of game or the type of player that Ricky was, and, you know, and he mentioned earlier about being the sort of central processing unit, that computer in midfield. And I suppose Xabi Alonso was very much of that ilk as well. You know, do you think that brain that is required to play that particular role and play football in that way, it is a brain that would also make a very good coach? I mean, I know it's impossible to say, you can't say all central midfielders make good coaches, but if you think about the brain power, the thought that goes into playing that position or being that type of player, clearly there's a lot of thought that goes into the game that could then be transferred into a coach.
Yes, I believe there's there'll be other ingredients that are needed in there as well, to be able to be a people person, to be able to impart, you know, these lessons, and to be able to teach, you know, so many different skills to be, you know, a football coach, a football manager. But yes, a player like Ricky, you know, that it's that analytical mind that those players have in that position that really should be able to kind of like certainly have a lot of wisdom to impart to players. You know, a lot of variables within that, as I say. You know, that need to be able to be a people person, to be, you know, to be personable, to be able to pick up all the nuances, you know, that you have to be, I don't know, something of a showman, something of a politician, something of a, you know, therapist. You know, you have to have a lot of strings to your bow. But yes, you know, the raw tools are there to be able to pick the game apart, because they've done it as a player. You know, they it's the type of player that see, you know, various angles of a pitch that others don't. You know, we talk about the David Batty's there and the Carlton Palmer's, effective players in fetching and carrying. And that sounds awful, and it's not meant to be, because football, you know, the very important elements of football. But then a player like Ricky, a player like Xabi Alonso are very, very different. And this is kind of like why, you know, Ricky only winning the three, you know, three England caps more than I ever will. You know, so, but you know, it's the frustration really is that, you know, as a player there, should have done so much more, but kind of like, I don't know, undone by the formation that was played, which wasn't really Bobby Robson's formation. You know, when you look at what he'd done with Ipswich, it was a different, you know, he had diamond midfield, and if he'd have played that for England, then Ricky would have fitted that perfectly. You know, it was like he came to the England job and felt that he had to play wingers because there was an abundance of them, rather than saying, this is the formation that I've succeeded with at Ipswich, and, you know, I'm sorry to the wingers, but, you know, you're just not part of that plan at the minute. Or you can be a substitute and I'll throw you on if we're 2-1 down with 20 minutes to go. You know, but, you know, that analytical mind that Ricky had, it kind of went to waste in a way. You know, certainly not for Luton. No, definitely not for Luton. But, you know, as within being an England player, within coaching, you know, people like Ricky should have been, you know, utilised so much. Whether that's, you know, at the highest level as the frontline manager at clubs, running academies, you know, somewhere there has to be, you know, roles within English football for the great thinkers. You know, and it's an utter waste of talent.
They're very profound words, my friend. Very profound words. Ricky, I want to... I mean, obviously, you know, like we said, Luton has run right through this, and obviously the ultimate coaching job, but certainly, I guess, a coaching job that's very dear to your heart, or would have been very dear to your heart, and was very dear to your heart, and that's the manager of Luton, you know, and that opportunity does come your way, you know, you eventually get there, and it's, to me, it's by far the best chapter in the book by an absolute mile. And that's not to say there's anything wrong with the others, but in terms of illuminating and what normal biographies go beyond, and, you know, that setting of the record, and, you know, we talked about it when we first sort of got on the chat before we started recording, you know, and it's that sort of want and desire by you to let fans know what happened, to put your side, because, like you say, you know, at the time, it's, things were different, but it's such an incredible chapter. And yet it's the most unbelievable sort of story. And it all happens. It all comes and goes so fast, so fast. You know, a job that's been, you know, sort of potentially in the offing since 1976 comes along, and then it's gone in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I mean, thank you, Stephen and Aidan, for those generous words again. I mean, it's fantastic. Thank you. I'm humbled. But you're right, Stuart. I mean, from my perspective, here I am, 508 games for Luton Town. You know, first England international player for 27 years, since Sid Owen in 1955. I've been away. I've gone to America. I've sacrificed. I've gone to Sheffield Wednesday, worked in the Premier. I've gone to Tottenham, worked in the Premier. I've honed my coaching skills. I've developed my philosophy. And a job at Luton becomes available. At Luton, they're in the doldrums, for want of a better word, for the last 3.5, 4 years in administration. So I then get the opportunity to become the manager by default, because Lenny Lawrence was the manager and he decided he didn't want to continue with the new consortium, so he left. I was offered to become assistant to Lenny, and I said, well, no, I'll stay at Tottenham, because I was offered to Lenny 5 years earlier and he didn't want me then, so I don't know why it would change now. And that was fine. 2 weeks later, they came and said, the job's available, would you like it? So I thought, great, ambition of mine. But as I've written in the book, my closest friend Q said to me years before, he said, by the time you get that Luton job, there'd be nothing there for you to work with. And those were prophetic words, so to speak, whereby you go there with the best intentions. I went with an open mind. I knew that they'd been struggling. I'd seen them play for over the past years on my visits to Kenilworth Road, and they were being ripped apart. All the better players had gone, and the club was just being held together by the seam, so to speak. So to then go there with someone else's team and be judged as a failure after 4 months, or perceived to be a failure by being released after 4.5 months, or whatever the case may be, is something that still rankles badly with me. There's so many different facets to the story, as you rightly said, Stuart, in terms of what you've read. I wanted to give an in-depth account because whilst I was getting into social media, I read someone say, absolute horrible manager. And that kind of was a thing that spurred me on to think, well, this person, he might be a Luton fan. He probably loved me as a footballer, potentially. He probably, you know, respected everything I'd done for the club. But now he's judging me and casting aspersions on me after a four-month period with someone else's team. And yeah, in difficult situation, certain circumstances that were unbeknown to many people. So I thought, I've got to get the record straight. I've got to get that bit off my chest, just to let people know exactly what I went into, exactly how I was treated, and why, irrespective of me having what I believe to be an ability to conduct myself in the right manner, to perform the duties as a manager and as a coach. And I think my 3 professional coach of the year awards in foreign countries with less resources and difficult circumstances and being away from home would attest that I can put a team together, that I can organise, that I can coach. And to be given 4.5 months at Luton Town after I gave almost 15 years of my career to them was something of a real kick in the groin, so to speak. So I wanted to get that. I wanted to get that out there. I wanted people to realise what I had to contend with, what I went into, the fly on the wall documentary, so to speak, of what took place, how I was treated, the disingenuous way that things had happened and were done, even to the point of me never signing the contract within the 4.5 months when I was there. You know, how ridiculous is that? But in my innocence or naivety, I was there to do a job. And I thought in good faith that these people had hired me to do a job. But then to go through all that, it's a great learning curve. But I think it also makes a great read from that perspective to think, well, wow, is that how they could treat someone who was considered to be a legend at that football club? So put the loyalty and sentiment aside, I still believe that if you're going to judge someone, the old adage used to be, you know, you can't judge a manager until he has his own team. And, you know, but all of a sudden in four months, that analogy went out the window where I was concerned. I was supposed to pick up whatever trash was there, and I mean that in the nicest possible way, without being disrespectful to the players, and then shine that up and turn it into jewelry and gold. And it was impossible for not only me or anyone like me, or even greater managers than me, and greater experience. So it was a tough time, a difficult period. In hindsight, I'd have done a little bit more due diligence with the personnel I was getting into bed with, so to speak. I might not have taken the opportunity that was presented at that time if I'd have known deeper to what the extent of things were at the club.
It's a sensational chapter. It's a tragic chapter, but it's a brilliant chapter to read. Since the book has come out, what has been the feedback to you? I guess A, from Luton Town fans, but I suppose the wider football community, because like I say, it's very rare you get insight. Like you say, you know, no contract. You talked about players that you put a value, maximum value of 150,000, and the board go and spend 450,000. It's mind blowing stuff, and I'm just interested in what the reaction has been since the book has come out.
I think the word that has been used more often than not, Stuart, and again, I didn't intend it to be that way, and this is coming from fans and neutrals, has been sad. People have been sad, right? You know, they said it's a great read, but it's a hard read at times, and it saddens me. And I think the sadness probably stems from the fact of, you know, they probably knew me as a player. They probably saw me and had me as someone who, you know, played a certain fashion, entertained, and did well, and served the game in a good manner. And then for them to read what had taken place after the sacrifice that I possibly have made and given, you know, throughout my whole career, it saddens them that I would be treated in that manner. And I do understand that, but I appreciate that their thoughts. But it wasn't intended to be. It was just one of those things where this is factual. And I know when you go into that world, you have to go in with your big boy pants on. And you have to be able to roll with the blows. But as I said to the chairman, when he was across the ocean after I'd been summarily dismissed, although they wanted to say it'd be a mutual agreement, mutual respect. And I said to him, you won't know the ramifications that this decision has on my career. And he tried to say, well, but Ricky, you know, you're a great coach. People at Tottenham and Sheffield, because that's not the point. There's not many black managers here now. And for someone of my standing who's affiliated with Luton the manner that I had been for so many years, people obviously, the neutral will obviously construe or believe that I was incapable, and that's why I had to be removed after 4 months. And that couldn't have been further from the truth. I'd done a podcast with Marvin Johnson about 4 weeks ago, and he was a veteran player at the time, and he got injured, which again didn't help me. But he said, you know, Ricky, I remember going back and you and Chris Ramsey again, first black British managerial team. Chris Ramsey's done brilliantly at Queen's Park Rangers and England under 20s. And, you know, he was a manager in the Premiership with QPR after Harry left, and then was manager in charge. So Chris and I were the first black managerial team. And we had Daley Thompson come in and take fitness training. We were doing twice a day. We were doing nutrition. We were doing private programs. And Marvin said, that was 20 years ago. You were way ahead. We never seen anything like that at the club. And you guys were way ahead of your time. You know, I say now. And so that makes it more frustrating for me, Stuart, sitting here thinking, well, you know, others have been given so much longer at Luton Town even. Players, without being disrespectful, that weren't at my level of elite play were given the opportunity to take Luton Town forward. You know, for however long it went, whether it worked out for them or not, then they left. Whereas the rug was pulled out from the bottom of my feet after 4.5 months. For no apparent reason, I could see anyway, than just the board's naivety.
The sense you mentioned, and I don't think it's sacrilege to write in a book, but it's the only thing that I've highlighted in your book. And it is, like you say, you know, you have no idea what the ramifications of your decision will do for my future career. And the minute I read it, I highlighted it, because that was the thing that struck me out the whole book. It was that single sentence and that statement. Aidan, you seem to have copped for a lot of the social stuff tonight, but I guess, you know, we sort of started with Ricky, you know, in the early days and black players in the game. You know, we've gone through things, and Ricky's career has run alongside it. And now Ricky's career is running alongside this almost disposable attitude, you know, that we have in Western culture almost with a lot of things. You know, and that's just instant dismissal, instant reset, start again, it's not working. You know, that time of patience, you know, we were just watching a preview of the Alex Ferguson documentary the other night. You know, the amount of time that he got at Manchester United to get it right. And, you know, there's a big difference, with all due respect to Alex Ferguson and Manchester United and Ricky Hill and Luton Town. However, the principle is still the same, that patience that get your own team in. You know, Alex Ferguson inherited a squad of players, notorious drinkers, you know, that he wanted to get his stamp on there, then judge him on what he can do. But now we're just not in that environment anymore.
No, that's true. But, you know, at that time, even at that time, Ricky cites a number of examples in similar eras of managers who achieved less in that short space of time, but were given longer to sort it out or longer to turn it around than Ricky was. And, you know, individual clubs have individual circumstances and so on. But, you know, this is an overall trend. This isn't just a case of Luton being a basket case at the time. There's a lot more to it than that. And I think, you know, Ricky mentioned some of the things from days not long before he became manager and while you're coaching elsewhere, you know, comments of Ron Nodes about white players had the brains and the common sense. That kind of attitude is, I mean, it's shocking to modern eyes, absolutely shocking. But that, and you talk as well about the people who are in the position to appoint coaches have no experience of ethnic minorities or anything to do with cultures and sectors of society other than their own. So what do they always look to? It's the familiar and it's what the tried and tested. And then, you know, the other comments, what Stu highlighted there is a great one to point out. But the other one that I also noted as well is when you're talking about your time at Sheffield Wednesday, coaching in the youth teams, but then you got a chance to take the first team on a couple of occasions. And the comment that you flagged from Benito Carbone, I thought that was absolutely fascinating about the first team session that you put on. You know, he said it was technical, imaginative, creative, I mean, intense. It was just like Serie A. And that, that fed your desire and made you feel great, of course, as well as the comments from the goalkeeping coach there, you mentioned Martin Hodge. But to me, this lays out the difference in the perception of coaches. It's the tried and tested and sticking with the orthodoxy or conformity or something of, you know, the comfort blanket of we'll just appoint what we know, the familiar. You know, we still see now the merry-go-round of the same few names getting jobs again and again and failing again and again and being given another chance. This is something that the likes of Ricky never got the chance to do. And yet these other people, you talked about coaching courses with Mark Hughes, and he's one of those names you were on a coaching course with. But, you know, that kind of attitude, the sticking to the conformity, that you can see it in those coaching methods that stood out in that quote of not looking to new ideas and innovation. But that's kind of a metaphor for the overall situation, I think, of, you know, sticking to the same old, we'll just appoint what we know without looking wider or opening our eyes to other possibilities or, you know, seeing what's right in front of us in some cases, but not really giving that opportunity. And, you know, when you're getting feedback from people who've played at that kind of level and that kind of experience, sort of, you know, they've grown up in football in a different culture and know a different way and is a bit more open-minded, to then see that, you know, it's so closed-minded. I know we'll probably talk about the Rooney Rule and so on in a second, but, you know, it's the whole situation is so closed-minded and the whole concept of opportunity, it you know, nothing is about giving anybody anything that isn't on merit. It's about opening the door to let people show their worth. And if you don't let them show their worth, anybody, this could be, but, you know, it's a cultural issue when it comes to ethnic minorities. But if you don't give the opportunity for people to show their worth, then how can they ever show it? You know, you'll only ever stick to what you know because it's I don't know, fear of an unknown or whatever it may be. It's a new idea, it's innovation, even if coaching methodologies doesn't mean it's different, but a different ethnicity of a coach doesn't mean they'll do anything that different. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. But, you know, if you don't open your mind to the actual letting people show what they can do, give them the opportunity, then move on with that. And how can they ever progress? And even then, in the case where Ricky gets short opportunities at Sheffield Wednesday, then obviously this stint at Luton, you know, to the comment you started this point off with, Stu, about what this would do to somebody's career. You know, we can say, as we did with players, that, you know, it's difficult in any situation. But in this, there's the added weight. We talked about the 17-year-old player with the added weight. Now there's the added weight of being a black coach, hoping for opportunities, but those opportunities not arising. And the fact that you get this mark against you for right or wrong, and, you know, in this case, certainly wrong from everything Ricky says about what happened behind the scenes at Luton, which is fascinating, to then have that held against, or, you know, maybe not vocally held against or whatever, but, you know, that's obviously there in people's minds when they look at, oh, Ricky Hill's applied for this job. Well, look what happened at Luton. And, you know, I don't think it's any coincidence that further opportunities that Ricky's had in coaching have been away from this country, to possibly more open-minded, even though America has had, you know, all sorts of social histories and still does, as we only too clearly know with race and society. But when it comes to coaching, it's light years ahead. And the Rooney Rule has obviously been a big thing for the last two decades almost. But, you know, the closed door, the closed minds, is such a huge thing. And that's, you know, what Ricky's experience highlights so well.
It's a brilliant link, and it's, you know, it's, I appreciate we've kept you well of the hour. I am really sorry. I'm sorry, not sorry. It's usually my favourite saying there. I am sorry, but I'm really not. The Rooney Rule, you know, and Aid alluded to it there, you know, with what went on in America, and it's, you know, you sat watching the television and it, you know, and it comes on, and it, and again, it's that, Aidan put it brilliant, it's that open-mindedness, and you know, Stephen mentioned it, a part of it when he was coaching and how people see things. And I guess that's a combination of all of that. And it's something that's so obvious and so simple, and yet is completely missing from the game here. And yet, you know, you're there as a coach and as a player who's experienced it. And again, within an instant, it's, oh, well, that would work at home. That would work, you know, that's what needs bringing in. That's what, you know, and it seems so obvious when we're reading it, and so obvious at the time, but yet it hadn't come in here. When you're, you know, when you sort of essentially bring this back, was there that same, I can't believe we didn't think of this, or was the reservation towards it and its potential outcomes?
Thanks, Aidan. It's a lovely address there again in regards to the racing side of things and the job. Yeah, no, what it was, Stuart, was the fact that I saw it and I thought, wow, you know, America with all their social histories, as we know, the abhorrent way that they had through slavery and civil rights issues. I thought if they could put something in place that would enable someone from outside of the normal recruitment hiring processes would be able to be seen from the black and the minority ethnic group, to give them a chance to address those who make the decisions. I thought if they could do it in America, then I'm sure England would grab this straight away and run with it, because we had had issues whereby former ex-black players who were first generation en masse were now finishing their careers and trying to forge a pathway into coaching via the same route at a professional level. And to date, they hadn't had much joy or opportunity, despite preparing themselves, as they were told, whilst they were still players, to go and get your badges sorted, go and to matches and scout, go and get yourself prepared as best as you can for when the opportunity does arise, that you'll be ready, prepared and accredited to go and do the job. They did all those things, but still they found themselves on the outside looking in, never being able to access the rooms whereby they can put their philosophy forward and express their identity and what they would do for the respective clubs, organisations. So the frustration was mounting. The PFA and all the governing bodies, the EFL and the Premier League, put together a steering group in 2003, I believe. And they used to meet quarterly in London, at one of the hotels down in central London. And they would just talk about ways of adding more diverse representation with the organisations and what could they do to ensure that qualified black and Asian ex-players would be able to put themselves forward and be seen to be considered for opportunities. So they were talking over this period of time. And I went to my first meeting in 2004, about October 2004. And whilst at the meeting, I realised that there was nothing really of note that had taken place in that whole 18 months. No one had come up with any ideas that were meaningful, idea that would change the current landscape, which was status quo. You know, job becomes available, like Aidan's alluded to, same personnel. You could get fired 3 months ago, and your body of work from that last 3 months when you got fired didn't really impede you from going and putting yourself forward for a new job. And for some reason, the powers that be that make the decisions, they would look at that person and think, well, okay, he just got fired 3 months ago. It wasn't because he was top of the league, but they still then give him a job and think that he was the right person for their organization. And I used to go, how does that work out? You know, what is it not on merit? Is it not any further about your last body of work anymore? Anyway, and I then decided at that meeting to say, well, has anyone looked outside the country to see how other countries that have had similar issues in terms of black players transitioning from players into coaches? Have they seen how they operate? And everyone in the room said, no. I said, well, right now, there's something called the Rooney Rule. And I said, it's no obligation. It's just one minority candidate gets to interview if a vacancy is there and it's been advertised, whatever the case may be. So they all got excited. They wrote things down. They said, they're going to go away. 3 months later, they came back and said, oh, it might be construed as positive discrimination. So I said, well, it's the willingness that I'm more interested in. It's not even so much, I'm not looking for tokenism, I'm not looking for positive discrimination. It's a willingness to do something. And there's something that might be a game changer in respects to just getting someone within the doors to meet with the people that make decisions. And there's, again, I must stress, no obligation to be given the job. And you have to be qualified. We're not looking for a leg up. No one's looking for something, an opportunity that they don't deserve. So they were kind of semi-dismissed it at that time. And the Premier League, the FA, all the governing bodies were there, stakeholders. I continued to press and I continued to liaise with the people in America, which I'd been over there to meet and see how it operates. And Belinda Lerner was the lawyer that put this thing, everything together. And Belinda and I were exchanging emails regularly and the Fitzpatrick Alliance. Anyway, we then moved forward and there's still not an appetite. And I go away, I'm back in coaching, I'm in America. And then I suddenly read that people are coming over from the States to discuss the possibility of a Rooney Rule, a ruling akin to the Rooney Rule taking place. And Cyrus Myrie, who's a civil rights lawyer, came over in 2011 and addressed the Houses of, I think House of Parliament, somewhere had a big meeting and whatever else. Anyway, I was found out that secondhand. I asked the PFA to keep me informed on any and every development moving forward with this Rooney Rule or a ruling akin to the Rooney Rule, because I believed I was the architect and the visionary for something like that to take place in the UK. And I expected to be kept in abreast of things and kept informed if we were going to move forward. Moved the dial forward now to 2016, and they introduced a voluntary recruitment code, which again was piloted by 10 teams. And it suggested that if a job was available, they would interview one black or Asian coach, minority coach, candidate for that position before filling the position. Unbeknown to me or those who actually witnessed this implementation, there was a caveat within there that said that as soon as the kickoff had taken place and the regular season had started, they could revert back, clubs could revert back to type and hire whoever they want without having to go through the pledge of interviewing anyone from a minority candidate perspective, minority ethnic perspective. So for me, that was a paper tiger, whereby it's a three-month window in the summer that you've got to interview someone if there is a vacancy. And we all know very few people are fired in the summer. They're fired before the summer, or they might be fired after the season started, and they started poorly. So I, again, voiced my displeasure. You know, if you're going to do something, let's do something meaningful. Let's not just try to pretend and tick boxes. And yeah, again, from the 10 that piloted it, there was no surprise to me that the following year, all 72 EFL clubs signed up to the voluntary recruitment code, because really it didn't affect them in any way whatsoever. They didn't have to change what they have been doing throughout the whole of their existence, whereby interviewing people that they may not want to interview, they just didn't. They would go to their preferred person yet again, their preferred hire recruitment process of whichever agents have whichever clients or whichever CEO personnel that he knows. They just went back to familiar, to type. So it meant nothing to me. And then the FA decided to implement the Rooney Rule in its entirety in 2017 or 18. And again, there was no acknowledgement of my role that to play it, that's played into this whole scenario. They just went and implemented it. And it's great that it's there to a degree. I'm more proud of the fact that the English Cricket Board, ITN, Channel 4, BBC, South Africa Rugby, they've all used parts of the concept of the Rooney Rule to improve their diversity in hiring practices. And that's something that, you know, I started way in 2004, and it's now actively in motion in this country. I'm disappointed that the Premier League have resisted for as long as they have. And Richard Scudamore was a total detractor from it in 2011, came out and said, no, we have no room for quotas or no room for a Rooney Rule in this country. Now, we're not talking about quotas, we're talking about opportunities. We're talking about level playing field. We're talking about racial diversity within the senior echelons of the game, including coaching, managerial, front office, directorship. So, but he missed the point completely. Now, it's no surprise that there's only been two Black British managers in the Premiership history to date, Chris Hughton, Paul Lynch. And I know Chris Coleman, and I wasn't sure if his manager at, where is it, Crystal Palace. I know his grandfather might be mixed race, so that might be the third. But when you consider the number of elite level Black players that have played in this country during the Premier League's era and beyond, to think that there's only been two Black British today is a real stain on the game as far as I'm concerned. So FA have it. We're now talking about FA leadership, football leadership code, again, voluntary. The FA are pushing forward about directors. And where I would just like to pick the bones out on that one initially is a couple of months ago, they wrote that there was a 48% sign up from all the clubs. Now, if the premise is to have equality and diversity of a more fair and equal respect, why isn't 100% of the clubs all signed up to it? To have only 48% would then suggest that the other 52% are not really for equality and diversity within the senior management of organisations. So that is a baffling to me. And now throw in the boycott that's coming up this weekend, where everyone's up in arms about online abuse and, you know, players getting discriminated against, which is totally wrong and is abhorrent. But why aren't we having the same level and appetite to suggest that today, historically, there's been a disproportionality that has excluded a whole generations of expat players? Can we not look at doing something meaningful, serious, intervention and reform now? And again, not quotas, not tokenism, but a fair process whereby they would also have the opportunity to put their best foot forward.
Can I just jump in again there, Stu? These points there, because obviously the Rooney Rule is an NFL instigated thing a couple of decades ago, and I like to follow a bit of NFL as well. And I know that it's something that has worked successfully there. But as Ricky says, it's not about, you know, the claims of tokenism and quotas are so closed-minded, to go back to what I was saying before, because it's not about that. It's not about getting the job. It's about getting the opportunity to show your worth. The best candidate is the one who still gets the job, if they're white, Hispanic, Black, Asian, whatever. But, you know, getting the opportunity to state your case, and it may not happen. And this is how it's happened in the NFL, and it's shown that this works. You may not get the job the first time. You may not get the job the second time. But the impression that you make on the people who are appointing, maybe you narrowly miss out, but, you know, they like your ideas. And when something goes wrong with the coach they did appoint, you know, you're there in their minds already. You've got that leg up because you've shown what you can do. Or other organizations, when you go again for another job, they you know, they'll speak to the other clubs that have already interviewed you. They'll know about you. They'll do their background. They will then know that you've already made a good impression. And it's the comments about even when you know that the job is definitely going to a certain candidate, still go anyway, because you still get that impression. And who knows further down the line where that will benefit you. And this has worked in the NFL. There's, you know, maybe there's still more to go. And I think that's true. But you know, this is working. There are more. It isn't just head coaches. You know, this is coaches at all sorts of different roles in the NFL teams. There's a vast array of coaching jobs there, but head coach is where it's most visible. And there are a number of black coaches there. Not enough compared to the proportion of black players is huge in the NFL, probably more than it is footballers here. But you know, it's getting through, and that's the thing. And it's not something that shouldn't be necessary. This, but it is necessary. It so clearly is. And if you don't let people get that foot in the door, then something has to be done to open the door for them. You know, however narrowly at first it is, just to get that opportunity. Because once you've got that opportunity to state your case, whole new world of opportunity opens up. And that's all it's about, as Ricky says. It's not about quotas or tokenism. It's just simply the chance to state your case and show your worth. And then who knows what happens from there? Because yes, the best candidate should get the job. Nobody is ever going to claim otherwise. But that best candidate may be somebody you've closed your eyes to previously.
I mean, Stephen, to me, sat here listening to Ricky and listening to Aidan there as well, do you think there's any sense of embarrassment amongst football authorities or football administrators at the situation that we're still in 2021? I mean, you know, yes, it's better. You know, Ricky's alluded to that it's better than it was, and yet the Premier League, you know, still has this refusal. We're still at 48% clubs. You know, do you not think there is either an element of embarrassment, or that the obstinance is that convincing that they just can't see they can't see what's wrong?
You'd like to hope, but that's what it is. It's a hope. It's a wing and a prayer. When push comes to shove, and it's not just football in this country. It's all sorts of corridors of power. It's the status quo is what is protected. You know, we've just seen it with the concept of the European Super League. You know, yes, not a great idea by any means of the imagination, but to hold up the current pattern of things, you know, the current system as being, you know, a paragon of virtue is the wrong thing as well. You know, this is something that needs to be taken apart and rebuilt. And yes, you know, for me, it's exactly the same. You know, this I don't know whether it's driven by fear or laziness or, you know, just an unwillingness to change. You know, I think that human nature, certainly white human nature, there is a fear of change. There is a fear of difference that doesn't need to be there. You know, not all change is you know, immediately for the worse. You know, change can be so much for the better as well. So, you know, it is simply a hope that there is embarrassment, but I don't think there is.
This podcast is going to be another. Congratulations, by the way. I'm joining being only the second two-parter in recording in the history of our podcast. One sort of not last question, but I guess a final thought. Do you or can you take personal pride in the likes of Marcus Rashford, Raheem Sterling, and what they're doing now and the position they hold in British society that transcends football? You know, they are, you know, certainly Marcus Rashford is listened to by my mum, and that's my yardstick as to whether or not someone's making an impression. Because if my mum knows about them, usually it's important, and she's never heard of footballers ever. So if she knows who Marcus Rashford is, the chances are Marcus Rashford is transcending quite a lot of the British community. But do you and can you take a personal pride and see what you've done and the part that you've played in his prominence and his platform that he can now speak on?
I don't know if I could take any credit or the part I played. I guess the part I played was to create this pathway whereby we have an equality on the football field, you know, and no one can never deny that right now, whereby if you are, whatever colour you are, if you are a decent player, you will get an opportunity to go and try to further your ambition, further your ability. As a footballer, you know, that's visually, that's what they see, that's what they want, that's what they desire. Where Marcus and Raheem have done brilliantly is the era that we're in, the global phenomenon that football is, has allowed them to become very secure in terms of their financial futures to a degree. All things being equal, if they invest correctly and do what they can have choices come the end of their careers. But what they where they've done well to use their platform, and you have to respect them immensely, is the fact that they've seen injustices that are taking place and have not been frightened of the backlash that will be inevitably come their way if they voice their opinion in regards to the disappointment of these injustices taking place. And that's magnificent. But they do come from that position of security, of being quality footballers, well-recognized, well-renowned, well-loved in their environments, secure backgrounds, good people in and around them, hopefully, that's guiding their careers. You know, if I had come out when I was 17 years old and said, I don't want to play anymore because of the racist abuse, I don't know if I would have had many people that would have sympathized with me at that time. I think they would have said, well, jog on then. Good luck in your next career, whatever that may be. Because, you know, the appetite and the sensitivity and the empathy wasn't there. Now, on the, from the social perspective, and particularly over the last year and a half since what took place in America, when it became a witness to everyone that saw Mr. Floyd lose his life because of racial injustice and racial inequality and social inequality and social injustices. Now it's topical and everyone's looking amongst themselves. And as bad as it is in America, we do have our own issues in the UK in all those aspects. And for Marcus to take it upon himself to say more needs to be done and hold people accountable is magnificent. And Raheem to say, well, I don't see anyone looking like me at Man City when I'm going to coach. And, you know, from a cultural perspective, if I want to talk about something that may not be something that a white person might understand, there's no one there that I can talk to and confide in. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And when you consider this day and age that there's 30% black and minority ethnic labor force on the field of play, and yet still a 0.03% outside of field of play in professional football, that those figures can't be right. That's so disproportionately labeled to one demographic as opposed to, you know, the non-white personnel that could play roles in that game. Now, if we are going to say that we are totally inclusive and the FA slogan is, you know, FA, football for all, does that mean only whilst we can play? Or does that also mean, you know, whilst we finish, we can then have another potentially 30, 40 years of employment within the only game that we've loved, that we've grown to love, that we serve, you know, some at an elite level, some international level. But yet still, come that sad day when we can no longer play, currently, we have to start looking at how ways of retraining and finding up another career, another professional. And I understand that all players have difficulty staying within the game and transitioning from player to coach, but disproportionality in terms of disproportionately black ex-players have historically had major difficulties in continuing their professional career in professional football. So I'm very proud of them. Lots more to do. I think the onus now is on the sponsors. I'm going to call them out again and I'm going to keep calling them out because right now the sponsors have their values and what did you call them, where they've got their list of things where they buy their policy, where they have, you know, principles, values, and various other things that they say, you know, equality, we want this, no discrimination, no that. But yet still, currently, they're funding the football industry to the extremes. And yet still, certain clubs within receiving those funds are not adhering to the same values and principles that these sponsors have as part of their DNA. So until the sponsors look at that and think, well, that's not a real reflection on society currently. I don't like the look of how that club's been run. There's not enough what we call diversity. I'm not talking about Chopford Boys, but just a reflection of society going through the whole system. Until that happens, they might have to withdraw certain funding streams to them and get their houses in order. And again, that will take reform, that will take intervention, and the government may have to play a part in that too.
I mean, Aidan, you know, we sort of, you know, we will draw this to a close. You know, it is, you know, it's an absolutely fascinating chat. But it's to me, and you know, listening to what I've listened to in the last couple of hours, and you know, and what I've read, it still astounds me that, you know, we're having this conversation, and yet there is still so little black or ethnic minority representation in the corridors of power. And that's not just football. That's not just a football thing. You know, people talked about be it the BBC, Channel 4, you know, wherever that may be, you know, we have people, you know, talking an awful lot of common sense, and the common sense, you know, to me is that you have a, you know, that any workforce, any organization, any business has a true representation of what makes up British culture or British society, surely, to get the best understanding and to work functionally and effectively. And yet we still don't.
No, we don't. And this is across the board. You know, this is there's been all sorts of, you know, gender discrimination is had a similar path in many ways when you're talking about organizations and executive level and all that kind of thing. And that's, you know, that's changed and is changing still. But race and all sorts of other issues as well are, you know, still in need of a lot more work. I think the difference from, you know, an ordinary company and a very visibly public company like the FA or the BBC or things like that is that, you know, they're so much more visible. And this is where the white male is still what reigns supreme, not just at the very top, but, you know, at the levels, the tiers just below that as well. It all still seems to be the same. It hasn't got there yet. And it is so visible, and there's still an awful lot more to be done, but it's exactly the same as the position in the coaching. It's the opportunity. It's the people appointing are closed-minded because they are in their own little world and haven't experience of anything else. So it's all the same. And I think if I can contrast Ricky's playing days with his issues as a coach, you know, as a player, for all the issues he had to face and so on, you know, his playing style of, you know, an apparent effortlessness at times, and I'm quite sure it wasn't, but, you know, it can appear that way to those of us watching because he's such a gifted player. But then when it comes to the coaching, apparent effortlessness is the exact opposite of what it is. It's a constant battle and struggle. And, you know, in Ricky's playing career, there was that battle and struggle too, but actually once on the field at the highest level, it was just this effortlessness and how it looked. Coaching, not at all. We're still a long, long way away from that.
It's been brilliant. Stephen, a real insight, I think, tonight.
Oh, it's been brilliant. You know, as much as things change, the more they stay the same as well. And that's the big thing. But, you know, I think the biggest thing for me is that Ricky and his generation, you know, have essentially split the football atom. You know, no matter still the mountains to climb, the glass ceilings to shatter, you know, the difference that they made, you know, can still be seen today, you know, very, very vividly on the pitch. It's off the pitch that it needs to catch up.
Ricky, you know, sort of, you know, it's been brilliant. It's been incredible. Like I say, it's been incredibly insightful. I know you're only a young man, but do you think we'll get to where the game needs to be in your lifetime or our lifetime?
Not at all. I'm afraid I won't see it. It'd be just be basically from the fact of, you know, we've been retired in numbers for 35 years. You know, I brought the idea of a ruling akin to the ruling rule 17 years ago. So it's nearly two decades now. And all that was to be given an opportunity to meet and greet people and put yourself forward. It wasn't to get a job. So the resistance that's taken 17 years for them now to say, okay, we might do that in the FA, which has how many positions, 12 or 14, and how many of those positions become available every year? Hardly any. And how many? So they really never use the Rooney Rule process too often because there aren't too many vacancies that come over. But where the vacancies are, the 92 professional clubs, they're not putting out in good faith, they're not implementing the rule as it should be done and having the appetite to do it in a fair and proper process and manner. At the moment, it's kind of the hidden caveats and they're going behind any kind of rules that they can. You know, Birmingham hired Lee Boyer after firing Karanka the same day. So one was fired in the morning, one was hired in the afternoon. So no proper process in terms of going around interviewing process that included someone from a black or Asian perspective had taken place. So no one should be fooled from the fact of, you know, what we hear about the strap lines, you know, the slogans, the strap lines, the hashtags, we're into what? I'm into what? There's still this great injustice that's taking place that no one at the moment is talking about. No one's talking about the lost generation of black ex-players who are qualified coaches that can't play a role within the game right now. And until the consciousness of everyone, and as the famous quote from Benjamin Franklin is, until those who are unaffected by the issue are as outraged as those who are, then things are not going to change. So from that perspective, I appreciate yourself, Aidan and Stephen, because I know where you're coming from in terms of that equality perspective, and you want to see fairness and equality for all. I would hope there are more like-minded people like yourselves out there than there are those who are closed-minded and status quo and no, dismissing those who they don't know anything about, totally without taking the time to try to get to know them and try to know if they do have the ability or not. So from that perspective, for me to see a great change, I can't see it happening in my lifetime, because it's so embedded right now in terms of those who are in the system and systemic and the structural racism that is involved in all institutions at this moment in time. It's going to take a long time for that to turn its way around to show an equality that we all hope for.
Ricky, all I can say is thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure.
Like I said, it's been I asked for an hour and you've given us 2.5. I am really sorry. I am sorry. Aidan, enjoyed it?
Oh, and then some. It's been one of the most fascinating chats I've ever had. Ricky's book and talking with Ricky and his experiences are utterly inspirational to me as a 40-something white man. Ricky talks about, you know, people with open minds and all of that, and hopefully there are lots more of that ilk, because the points he makes and the way he makes them are so strong and powerful. So can't recommend it heartily enough, and thank you so much for this time. It's been absolutely magnificent.
Stephen, I think, like you say, I think Ricky's Panini sticker is now worth a shiny badge, let alone anything else in the playground.
Definitely. I was going to say exactly the same thing. definitely get a shiny badge for Ricky Hill.
Like I say, Ricky, it has just been an absolute pleasure. I'm so grateful for your time. The book is, like I say, the book is outstanding. And like I say, even if it's just for the chapter at Luton Town, which just about, I think, sums up probably this entire conversation in one chapter, from the lead up, what you went through to get the job, and then the impact of post-job, it's sensational. It is just a wonderful, wonderful book. And congratulations on that. Congratulations on your playing career. Congratulations on, like you say, opening minds and trying to make the changes that really, really matter in the game that we all love. But unfortunately, doesn't treat everybody quite so fairly or love everyone quite so evenly.
Thank you ever so much for having me, and Aidan and Steve. Thank you.
A pleasure.
Thank you, Ricky.
All that's left for me to say is to thank people who have listened, and please join us again. I can't promise it'll be as engaging or as insightful, but please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.